From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Asia recently pushing sanctions against North Korea with our Asian allies. And China-Australia relations are in the spotlight again. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board here on a sunny summer day in New York City. And I'm joined by my friend and colleague, editorial board member Hugo Restall, who is at an undisclosed location in Asia Pacific. I'm imagining him sitting on the veranda at Raffles Hotel in Singapore. Maybe he's enjoying a Singapore sling. We don't know. Hello, Hugo. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Mary. It's great to be with you again.
So Secretary of State Pompeo attended the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Conference for the first time as the United States' top diplomat. And he's urging enforcement of U.N. sanctions against North Korea. Lots to talk about here. A member of the North Korean delegation also delivering a letter from dictator Kim Jong-un for President Trump to the U.S. delegation at that conference. But let's start at the beginning, Hugo. What exactly was Pompeo asking of our allies? Aren't they all enforcing sanctions against North Korea?
The enforcement of the sanctions has never been complete and perfect. Previously, earlier in the year, the enforcement was tightening, but since the June 12th summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore, our allies and our adversaries have felt it no longer the need to enforce those sanctions quite so rigorously. And so the North has been able to sell its coal and other natural resources and buy the essentials that it needs for its economy. So these sanctions have become quite porous.
Quite porous. So essentially, North Korea gives a little bit. They have returned the remains of some U.S. Soldiers, fallen soldiers from the Korean War. Not all of them, of course, just a few. And so they look like good guys in that they're doing something for us. And now they want us to do something in return?
Right. So the June 12th agreement in Singapore had very little specifics. It was mostly a vague promise to pursue denuclearization. But a couple specifics that it did have or emerged at that meeting were that North Korea would return remains of U.S. servicemen and that it would dismantle a missile test stand. And the North Koreans, I think the last time we talked about this issue, they had not followed through on those promises. Now they have. And of course, now they want to be paid. They want some sort of concession from the U.S. You know, they have not done anything concrete on denuclearization, which was the main point of the agreement. But from their point of view, they always get paid for doing little things. And so the U.S. should now be relaxing the sanctions, not tightening them. And that was the gist of the foreign minister's remarks at the summit. And he's complaining that the U.S. is now violating the agreement in Singapore, while the U.S. is complaining that North is not moving towards denuclearization. So there's a certain irony here of both sides complaining that they're not getting what they expected from this agreement when there was very little of substance in the agreement itself.
Yeah, I noticed the administration is not talking a lot about CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. And we have a terrific editorial that's up on WSJ.com/opinion. I'd recommend it to everyone. It's titled North Korea's Complaint. And it sets out not just the breaking of sanctions, but also, Hugo, the language that was used here, simultaneous actions in phase steps. That's a quote that was in this June agreement. I mean, by that measure, phased steps, does North Korea have a point here that they've upheld their end of the bargain?
Well, I would say no, but from their point of view, perhaps. I mean, they expect that they will get what they've gotten from previous agreements, which is bribes and extortion payments in order to freeze their program. and they have no intention of following through on denuclearization. So from their point of view, yes, is situation normal? Why isn't the U.S. Relaxing the sanctions? So, you know, from their point of view, it's why the U.S. made a bad deal. Didn't insist on specifics, so, you know, why aren't you paying up?
Yeah, well, I was reading the transcript of the press conference, the sort of impromptu press conference that Secretary Pompeo held on his way back to the United States from that ASEAN conference, and he was asked several times about the denuclearization efforts and how it was going, and he came off as kind of tetchy, Hugo, didn't really want to answer the questions. I'm wondering what happened to the urgency here, because Pompeo said earlier this year, prior to taking the job as Secretary of State, that North Korea was in a range of only a few months of putting the U.S. mainland, what he called, at risk. And now we're into August. Well, golly, are they not putting the U.S. mainland at risk anymore? How do we suddenly have all of this time to negotiate with them?
Right. So the U.S. officials are bending over backwards to put the best face on this situation. John Bolton was on a Sunday show on Fox saying that the Trump administration is holding a masterclass in holding the door open for the North Koreans. So it's
our national security advisor.
Nice way of putting it. Yeah. Bolton is known to be a North Korea hawk, so I'm sure this really sticks in his craw, having to defend what's going on. But, you know, I think the bottom line is that the Trump administration probably doesn't want to go toe-to-toe with North Korea again before the midterm elections. You know, the North Koreans could stage provocations, you know, attack the South, shell an island or sink a ship. And
all things they've done in the past, by the way. All things they've done in the past.
So, That would be their standard procedure when they're not getting what they want. So, you know, I think the U.S. has to abandon this approach at some point. The question is timing. And as you say, we don't have a lot of time. There was a U.N. report that was submitted to the Security Council on Friday, which detailed all the problems. The North is continuing to build missiles and missile parts at various facilities. It's continuing to refine nuclear material. It needs to build warheads, and the trade in coal and other material at sea continues. You know, North Korean ships are docking at sea with other vessels and transferring the goods, and then returning to their ports. So, it's becoming very clear that none of the measures needed to push North Korea to make a big concession and agree to complete verifiable irreversible denuclearization are holding up. So
it's not working.
It's really putting lipstick on a pig at this point.
Yeah, it's just not working, to put it bluntly. But Hugo, let's step back from North Korea for a second and just talk about Pompeo at the ASEAN meeting. There have been secretaries of state in the past that have skipped these kinds of gatherings. I think it's positive that Pompeo showed up at the very minimum, and he wasn't just in Singapore, was he? He also took some time to meet with countries around the Mekong Delta region. There were some announcements there. What was notable there, Hugo, to you? What stuck out?
Well, Pompeo gave a fairly important speech last week about the Indo-Pacific. And the U.S. intention to offer more funding for infrastructure, along with its allies, to counter the Chinese Silk Road Initiative, Belt and Road Initiative, it's also known as, by which it's lending more than $1 trillion in the region to build ports, railways, airports. And the U.S. has been highly critical of China's approach, calling it debt diplomacy, because the high debt that these countries incur then makes them beholden to Beijing, and when they can't pay it off, they have to, cede control over these projects to Chinese companies. And so the U.S. Is now stepping up with money to address the region's infrastructure shortfalls, which is positive, but the money isn't quite there yet. I mean, the amount that Pompeo talked about is just $113 million. There's a promise of possibly another $6 billion if a bill makes it through Congress. And then other countries like Australia and Japan would presumably stump up money as well. So it's a start, and it's positive, but at this point it's really way too small to say at this point that the U.S. is really challenging the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Well, I did think it was positive that Pompeo met with his counterparts from India, Australia, and Japan, the three serious, important, major, whatever word you want to call it, democracies in the region that together encircle China. And there does seem to be an effort on behalf of this State Department to forge closer ties between those three nations and with the United States. I mean, this has been going on for years, Hugo. I remember the initiatives that the George W. Bush administration was making, very similar idea that they share our values, they share our concerns about Beijing and Beijing's march to its near abroad. Hey, let's get them all together in a room and talk and see if we can cooperate more. That effort seems to be continuing.
Right. I mean, that's the Quad idea of the four countries, but India is still not really on board. So that is the focus of trying to bring them into this grouping. But it's also very positive that Pompeo was in Malaysia and Indonesia talking to leaders there. I mean, these are things that, the Bush and Obama administrations neglected to a certain extent. And, with the recent election of a new government in Malaysia, the opposition winning, they are reexamining their ties with China and the projects that China was financing there. So there's a lot of potential for bringing Malaysia closer as a closer partner of the U.S.
Well, that'd be good news. We're talking about Mike Pompeo, North Korea, and we're turning to one of our favorite countries next. You're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from The Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts. From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York, Hugo Restall somewhere out there in Asia Pacific. And we are turning to one of my favorite countries, Australia. Great continental democracy. Love them down there. There's a new book out from former Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr. It's raising questions again about Canberra's relationship with Beijing. Hugo, the book is called Run for Your Life. What's the premise here?
Well, Bob Carr has made a new career for himself after government of essentially becoming a shill for Beijing. And he is now peddling this line that there's an anti-China panic in Australia. And the anti-China Taliban, made up of journalists and academics, are coming after him and anyone who's friendly towards Beijing. What's actually happened is that after Australia discovered that Chinese businessmen were funneling donations from United Front organizations under the Communist Party to Australian politicians, who were then taking the Chinese line on various foreign policy issues, Australia has now amended the laws on contributions to politicians, so that foreigners are not allowed to give donations anymore. Something that was long overdue. Most countries already do, and so Australia is looking at its relations with China and the influence campaigns that Chinese agents essentially are conducting within Australia. And
they're numerous.
This is going to be a major battle.
Yeah, as it well should be. Although, of course, Bob Carr is on the wrong side of it. Former Labor foreign minister, I might add. Hugo, just for listeners out there who haven't been following this, when you talk about United Front activities in Australia, United Front, of course, pushes the Communist Party's goals abroad. Let's just go through a few of these. You mentioned politicians taking Chinese money. I'll just name one guy, Labor Senator Sam Dastyari, who accepted money from Chinese sources to settle his personal debts. That's just one of them. And you got the universities and the pro-Beijing activities on campus, effectively right. trying to intimidate people who want to speak honestly about the Communist Party. I mean, am I missing other things here, Hugo? Add to the list.
No, that's well, Bob Carr himself runs an institute at the University of Technology, Sydney, which has been funded by some of these Chinese tycoons who were giving money to Sam Dastyari and other politicians. But as you say, there are now Chinese front organizations on Australian campuses which intimidate Chinese students there from speaking their mind in class. And a professor at Macquarie University, Kevin Carrico, has pushed back against this and tried to protect his students. And the Chinese media has gone after him and called him an anti-China zealot. You know, Bob Carr is talking about, you know, McCarthyism coming to Australia. There's a very good article by Kevin Carrico in the South Sydney Morning Herald in the last few days, which I recommend taking a look at, talking about how he was how he's been demonized by the Chinese media. There's also a very important article by Ross Garneau, a former reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald, who now works for the Australian government, talking about the prevalence of United Front organizations in Australia. And he describes how they're actually now under the umbrella of the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army department known as the Liaison Department, which conducts influence operations in enemy territory. You know, this is now a major topic of conversation within the Australian political sphere. And Bob Carr is, you know, way out on one wing. I would say both parties now are quite alarmed by it. And it's a bipartisan effort, with Bob Carr being a extreme outlier in the sort of pro-China camp.
Well, thank God. And just to give listeners a sense here of the distances involved, I just looked this up. It takes 12 hours to fly from Sydney to Beijing. Just to give you a sense of the distance that China's influence has traveled. We're not talking about Hong Kong, a territory right on China's doorstep. We're not talking about Macau. We're not talking about Nepal. We're not talking about a country that borders China. We're talking about a country that's a 12-hour flight away. Hugo.
Right. Australia really is the canary in the coal mine for a few reasons. One is, you know, it's traditionally been such a staunch U.S. ally, but, you know, it's been vulnerable, A, because it hadn't addressed these laws on contributions.
These loopholes.
So it was a soft target.
Right.
But it's also highly dependent economically on China. It exports a lot of iron ore and other minerals to China. So economically, it's you know, people are afraid that if they anger Beijing, that there might be significant repercussions. And also, its publicly funded universities are highly dependent on the tuition from Chinese students. And so those universities don't want to rock the boat because if the flow of Chinese students was interrupted, there would be a major funding crash within the Australian educational system.
No, it's all kind of pathetic, isn't it, Hugo? Because there is such thing as a budget, and these universities could control their budget better. We're having that debate here in the United States, but that's a different area altogether. We'll leave that for the Potomac Watch podcast. But yet it's another argument for opening up new markets and for opening up markets in particular to U.S. allies like Australia. Now, we have a U.S.-Australia free trade agreement that was done under the George W. Bush administration. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership, not to harp on it, but that was an effort to bind together the non-Chinese trading countries of Asia-Pacific. And President Trump ran against it, said he could was a bad deal, quote unquote. But I'm not sure that the administration appreciated the strategic implications of the deal as well as the economic benefits of it. You could argue over whether the TPP was a quote unquote best deal that the United States could have gotten. Maybe we could have gotten more market opening. I don't know the answer to that. But strategically, I think it was a blow to countries like Australia to have the United States bow out.
Oh, definitely. The TPP was critical to, as you say, binding together the democracies in the region and the countries that didn't want to become overly dependent on trade with China. And it would have extended supply chains among those countries and essentially, you know, bypassed China in a lot of respects. So, you know, if even if you're upset with China about you know, trade issues, TPP is actually a model deal. I mean, a lot of the things that the Trump administration is talking about trying to get in bilateral deals now with Canada and Japan are things that were in the TPP deal. So it was a huge own goal for the U.S. to pull out of TPP.
Well, we're unfortunately out of time today, so we'll leave it at that. Another gloomy note. Thanks for listening to Foreign Edition. On behalf of Hugo and myself, Mary Kissel, thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Wednesday.